Do women really think about sex less often than men? Daniel Bergner will tell us what women really want.
She was showing straight women straight porn, gay porn, images of women, and famously now, images of bonobos having sex.
Also, from the author of American Rust, Philip Meyer will be here to talk about his new novel, The Son.
After he's gone, the rest of the family thinks of him as a kind of a disgrace and a failure, but he's the one person who actually sees with a sort of clear moral eye in terms of the cost in human lives and in blood.
Linear B, a code it took 50 years to crack. Marguerite Fox will tell us how it was done.
And over the years, she hand-cut and annotated 180,000 of these index cards.
And Greg Coles will have bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Daniel Bergner is here to talk about sex. The book is What Do Women Want? Adventures in the Science of Female Desire. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
So, this is your second book about sex.
It is. Second book about desire. Couldn't stay away.
Now, the first book was called The Other Side of Desire. And what was that about? And did that lead to this book?
It did in a way. So that book was four novella-length nonfiction stories, really, where I just stuck close to four characters whose erotic lives, I think it's fair to say, fall well outside the sort of mainstream. It was as I was talking to researchers and psychologists about those characters that one of them said, hey, you've really got to come to the lab of my wife. She's doing fascinating research. That was Meredith Chivers, who was doing many things, among them comparing what women say turns them on versus what their bodies say via a little device called a plethysmograph. And from there, spent time with her in her lab, listening to her interpretations and thoughts as well, and then branching out to other researchers. And finally, always important to me, listening to the stories, in this case of everyday women, and threading those through the book.
Now, you're a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Did you start off with an article for the magazine and then it expanded into a book?
It did. What happened was I was talking to my editor at the magazine, Elena Silverman, and telling her about some of the research that I'd seen during reporting The Other Side of Desire. And that led to, let's look at Meredith's research. Let's look at the research of a couple of other female scientists, Marta Mayana and Lisa Diamond. And that then led to a longer book project.
So the obvious question, well, there are many, but the first one is, well, you're a man. What do you know about this?
In a sense, absolutely nothing. There's an unbridgeable gap to try to cross here. And I guess I could see that on the one hand as an impossible disadvantage, but I hope in the end it was an advantage because it was that perhaps rare journalistic project where I actually came with very few, if any, preconceptions, or in any case, an awareness of very little sure knowledge and just a wish to ask relentless questions. And I asked the same question a zillion different times of the same people again and again and again, and just a desire to listen.
And so you talk about going to that first lab and seeing what that researcher, Meredith
Chivers,
was doing. What was she doing that was so interesting that you felt like hadn't been covered before?
She was getting a really consistent and striking difference between what women were saying, which they, you know, expressed via a keypad, versus what the plethysmograph was showing about their bodily response to a range of pornography. So a few examples. She was showing straight women straight porn, gay porn, images of women, and famously now, images of bonobos having sex, and getting this strong bodily response across the board, despite women saying something much more predictable, which is that straight women were responding to straight porn, gay to gay porn. And then this in turn compared to the result she got with men, which was much more predictable and in a sense much more dull.
Men knew what they wanted and their bodies said the same thing.
Exactly.
Women, it was...
they matched up perfectly and women's didn't. And then
more
the question was more complicated. Yes. More, maybe more fascinating. Yes. But at the same time, what the last 8 years, and this has been 8 years of reporting, have kind of revealed is maybe also just as raw and in some ways just as straightforward as male desire. And that's something I think our culture still is made uncomfortable with. It cuts against our assumptions, cuts against the teachings of evolutionary psychology, which, of course, have taught us that men are programmed genetically to spread their seed, to be promiscuous, women to seek out one good man and thus to be more suited to monogamy.
How convenient.
What I have often thought, how convenient and even more how comforting to men, how soothing to me to think that while my thoughts might wander, my partner's thoughts are going to be mostly focused on me. It's hard to imagine how this fable has lasted so long.
Now, a lot of this evolutionary psychology comes from the study of other primate behavior, from animal studies, and you mentioned the bonobos. So tell us about that.
The evolutionary psychologists ground their thinking in the study of what our behavior is presently, and from that, they tell us what our behavior was prehistorically. And from that, they tell us that our behavior presently is a genetic inevitability. And I think you can hear there's a kind of clear circular reasoning there. One thing I did, in addition to talking to everyday women and talking to scientists, most of them women, was to spend time at a primatology center where a very prominent researcher was saying, hey, wait a sec, look at our close ancestors. We've long thought males the aggressors, males the sexual initiators. Not once we take the blinders off. And I have this character, Deirdre, who's one of my favorites in the book. She's a female monkey, and she is nothing but the sexual initiator. She's like all females of her species, the sexual aggressor. If there's any objectification going on in the monkey kingdom, it's females objectifying male monkeys. And here's funniest of all. The primatologist has to cycle out, get rid of the males every couple or 3 years because the females get bored of having sex with them.
So what conclusions can we draw from this? I mean, you know, it's tempting, of course, to then have our own just so conclusions. But obviously, they're very different creatures from us in many ways.
Very different. And of course, I'm not equating monkeys to humans, Deirdre, to any woman that I've spoken to. But I think at the very least, what we can conclude is that we need to sort of, you know, kind of strip away the societal blinders and look at ourselves. And I really mean ourselves. I don't just mean women. I mean women and men and the kind of dynamic between us and the things we've taught ourselves. Look at things anew and see if we can see things more clearly and I think ultimately more candidly. And I actually think what science is showing us is a kind of understanding of female sexuality that's ultimately empowering to women.
Since we're looking at this for ourselves, for you, did you have an assumption that was just seriously destroyed during the process of researching the book?
I came to the project looking for what's known as an essentialist vision. And essentialism is the idea that there's some kind of biological script that will determine everything. And I don't want to overstress that. I wasn't thinking 100% or even 80%, but looking for that sort of 60% genetic biological factor. And I think that's true of the first researcher. I spent time with Meredith Chivers as well. And I think over the 8 years, both of us in tandem, though of course separately, have gravitated toward an understanding that sees the role of social forces much more strongly. And so, you know, I end the book with a study of speed dating, which I think is kind of symbolic. In most speed dating situations, men approach the women. Women sit and wait. And then at the end, you check a box. Both sexes do. Do you want another date? What was your level of desire, et cetera? Ingenious researchers decide, well, let's see what happens if we flip that around, have the women approach the men. And it was incredible. The outcomes were flipped. and almost immediately flipped so that when women were approaching men, the levels of desire, the numbers of boxes checked for, yes, I'd like a second date, soared right to the level of the men. And I mention that just to say, it's almost like a new reality was kind of dancing into sight for a second with those results. And I guess let's see with the blinders off and see what that reality really is.
What is that saying, that the desire soared in those instances?
It's saying that the social structures that we take for granted,
the men asking the woman out for the date,
men initiating, men moving, the simple act of moving toward the woman who is sitting and stationary and thus made to be passive, is very determinative and affects emotion, affects psychology in a way that we, I think, barely reckon with. We take this for granted throughout.
And that it suppresses the desire, or that the desire is enhanced if you flip it around.
It suppresses desire. It distorts what might powerfully be there. And I think we don't normally recognize this because we think of ourselves in a really sex-saturated society, a society where sort of the sexual restraints are completely off. And I don't think that's yet really completely true.
Well, it sounds like there are lots of misconceptions about female sexuality out there. Is there something that's leading you to the next book in the same way that you were drawn from your first book into this?
I am going to take a detour on the next book, and I've got a wonderful story that also started with the New York Times Magazine article, but it's actually about opera. So in a sense, it's about desire, but it's about a wonderful and improbable young opera star. And then I'm going to veer back to desire one more time.
Okay. Well, after then more than a decade of having to say at cocktail parties that you were working on a book about sex, you can move on to another subject, at least temporarily.
Just briefly.
Okay. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is the award-winning audiobook of the year, read by Colin Firth. It's Graham Greene's classic, The End of the Affair. That's Colin Firth reading The End of the Affair, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
I am talking to Philip Meyer. He is the author of The Sun, which is reviewed in this week's issue of The Book Review by Will Blythe, who calls it a masterly second novel. Philip, welcome.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi. You're in Austin, correct, where you spend half the year?
Exactly right. And I'm just starting my book tour.
Okay. This is your second book, The Sun. Your first, American Rust, came out in 2009, right?
Exactly.
Tell us, for those who haven't read the book, what is this book about?
Thematically, it's about the American creation myth, you know, where we all come from, the sort of sense we have about what our history is and, you know, how the land was settled. That's a sort of backstory. It's about one family in Texas. It follows them for 175 years from the settlement of the frontier in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, and the fairly constant combat with the Plains Indian tribes at that time, through the kind of family's rise as a cattle dynasty and then a kind of an oil dynasty, and follows them through the kind of big transformations, both in Texas and in the 20th century America more broadly. So it follows them up until about 2012.
Now, you are not born and bred Texan, right? But you now spend half your year there.
Yeah, I moved here for graduate school about 9 years ago, and I kind of fell in love with the place. I mean, part of me, I was actually born in New York, and part of me really loves New York and likes the kind of cultural and intellectual life there. But there is something about Texas. Texas still has some incredible optimism, and there's a sort of a friendliness and a warmth to it that I think it's hard to find in the Northeast, I think.
And this book, I think, would probably give no hint to the fact that you were once an investment banker, right?
That's right. After college, I worked for a few years as a derivative trader with the Swiss bank.
And so you did not go the route of writing the sort of inside the financial world hijinks kind of novel, but something very different here.
In fact, I did. My second unpublished novel was about a kid from the provinces who goes and works on Wall Street, and the sort of hijinks ensue. It was very bad. I couldn't get it published.
Will it ever see the light of day?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'll give it to a university or something. But, no, it's quite bad. It would be embarrassing to have. It's your early work, and you can feel proud of it at the time. But to show it now would be like a professional athlete being proud of the games they had played in high school or something. I mean, it's just something that's from a different time in your life.
Well, this is your sophomore published novel, and it's come out really to rave reviews. Will Blythe calls it masterly and refers to it as an epic of the American Southwest. Now, tell us about the protagonist, the paterfamilias of the novel.
Sure. This is a guy named Eli McCullough. He's born in 1836 on a sort of the day of Texas independence. Texas becomes a country on that day, and is actually a country for about 10 years before it's annexed as a state. And he sees the kind of, he's sort of living manifest destiny, the sort of rise and takeover of the frontier by Anglo settlers. He lives through the Civil War, fighting for the Confederates. There's long sections in the book about the Civil War in the West, which is sort of ignored and involved a lot of Native American tribes actually fighting on both sides of that war. And then he participates in the very brief rise of the cattle industry in the U.S., which, even though it's sort of deeply embedded in our mythology, only took place over about 20 years. And then in 1886, collapsed fairly completely.
And this is multi-generational, the story. So it goes through Eli, and then I'm assuming the next generation. Is there a reason? Why is it called The Son?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a play on words. Eli's son is called Peter, and he's born in the 1870s. He's sort of the polar opposite of his father. He's highly moral. He's also fairly passive. He's the sort of moral voice of the book and of his family. And after he's gone, the rest of the family thinks of him as a kind of a disgrace and a failure. But he's the one person who actually sees what his father does and sees what the other Anglo settlers do and the other Texans do with a sort of clear moral eye in terms of the cost in human lives and in blood. The third character is called Jean Ann McCullough, and she has what you might think of as a sort of traditionally a masculine role, in the sense that she's the one who, against everyone's expectations, takes over the family, saves it from bankruptcy, and this is during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, basically turns the family into kind of a modern, super wealthy dynasty after her father nearly runs it into the ground.
So Jeannie is the granddaughter of Colonel Eli McCullough.
Yeah, great-granddaughter, exactly, yeah.
A great-granddaughter, okay. And she takes the story all the way up to 2012?
That's right.
How did you deal with that huge sweep of time in the book?
Well, so I actually did it initially as a challenge, because American Rust, my first book, took place over about 14 days, and I wasn't sure how you write a book that sort of takes place over such a long time period. I originally thought this book would maybe span 50, 75 years. And the more I realized about the what I was really getting at in terms of the sort of commentary on our mythology, the more I realized it would have to span a much longer time period. And I guess the way you do that is you sort of focus on the important events. What are the turning points in the lives of your characters? I mean, if you look at all of our lives, most of our lives are not really story material. You know, there's sort of a few pivotal times, and I think if you're sort of a great person like Jean Ann is and her Eli is, you have maybe many of these, starting in childhood and continuing into, late middle age. So you focus on those sort of pivotal moments when people either, accomplish their goal or fail at it, or learn something about themselves.
Well, I'm gonna read from our review, which was written by Will Blythe, and Philip has not heard this review yet. So he says that by the novel's end, that you've demonstrated that you can write a potboiler of the first rank. And then he goes on to say, only in the greatest of historical novels do we come to feel both the distance of the past and our own likely complicity in the sins of a former age had we been a part of it. To that rank, we now add the sun. So, and that's just, I think, the most recent of what have been really glowing reviews for the book. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And we look forward to reading your next sweeping epic.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Philip Meyer, author of The Sun, his second novel, which is reviewed by Will Blythe in this week's issue of The Book Review. I'm here with Marguerite Fox. Her new book is The Riddle of the Labyrinth, The Quest to Crack an Ancient Code, reviewed this week by Donovan Hone. Hi, Margo.
Hi. Thank you so much, Pamela.
So this is a book about code breaking, and the code is Linear B. Tell us the story of Linear B.
Linear B is an ancient script that was used for writing some language. Nobody knew what. For a long time. In the Aegean Bronze Age, it was incised into clay tablets by royal scribes in about 1450 BC, and then it was forgotten for three millenniums, and it was unearthed again only in the spring of 1900 by the great English archaeologist Sir Arthur Evans.
And where did he discover this, and what did he find exactly?
He found, over years, a couple of thousand tablets in the ruins of the great palace at Knossos. He determined that this was the historic basis of the legendary palace of King Minos, the man who had the labyrinth with the fearsome Minotaur at its center built for him. And indeed, the palace at Knossos was a vast, sprawling edifice, bigger than Buckingham Palace, with hundreds of rooms linked by the network of twisting passages, hence the title of my book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth. And within some of those rooms were chambers and chambers of these inscribed clay tablets containing a script that Arthur Evans named Linear B, that was full of strange little pictograms of horses' heads and chariots and swords and things that to modern eyes look like shirt buttons and telegraph poles. No one knew what the tablets said, nor did they even know what language they were written in. So it became one of the great decipherment problems of the modern age.
Because there was no Rosetta Stone. There was sort of no hint, right?
That's exactly right. If you are an archaeological decipherer, your fondest dream, what you pray for fervently every night, is for what they call a bilingual inscription to surface that will contain the script you're trying to decipher on one side, plus a known language in a known script on the other. And the best known historic example is indeed the Rosetta Stone, which was inscribed in these beguiling ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics on one side and classical Greek, which of course was well known. And the discovery of that stone allowed, at long last, the Egyptian hieroglyphics to be deciphered in the 19th century. But however fervently the would-be decipherers of the Linear B script prayed for a corresponding bilingual inscription, none was ever found for Linear B, nor has one been found to this day.
Now, how did you come to this story? I think, you know, our listeners may know you, of course, as one of the great obituary writers for The Times, but you're also a linguist.
That's right. My original academic training is in linguistics. I have bachelor's and master's degrees in linguistics from Stony Brook, and then another master's in journalism from Columbia. So I try to combine both my original training with my journalistic vocation in my book writing life and write popular nonfiction books for a general readership about language.
Well, I had this fantasy that you were writing the obituary of one of the people involved and became interested in this particular story, or did it happen some other way that you...
No such luck, because, of course, the principals all died well before I was born. Although, in a sense, you're right. I do consider this book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth, to be a kind of make-good of the three principal actors in the drama, the English archaeologist Arthur Evans, who unearthed the tablets in 1900, the English architect Michael Ventris, who, against all predictions, deciphered Linear B in 1952, and the great unsung heroine of our story, Alice Kober, a professor of classics right here at Brooklyn College, who is the figurative and literal centerpiece of our book, because it was her work, long unknown, that truly set the stage to make Ventris's decipherment possible. Kober and Ventris died very young. When Kober died at the age of 43 in 1950, just 2 years before the riddle of the script was solved, the New York Times did one of these sort of cursory de rigueur obits of the kind we did for local professors then. It was very short, maybe 200 words. It listed her job titles and the group she belonged to, and had maybe one sentence on Linear B, and that was it. When Michael Ventris died in 1956 at 34, just 4 years after solving the riddle of the script, the New York Times, and ditto for many American papers, did not publish an obit of him at all. I think for no other reason than oversight. It was a less reasonable proposition to get timely news from across the Atlantic then. American readers weren't well versed in the Linear B story, so it could well have been that his obit just slipped through the cracks.
So you've given them their fair due here.
I hope so. So I consider this book a way of upholding my daytime profession in really writing the lives of Kober and Ventris, two people who should have been written up in our pages at the time, but weren't.
The book is really a sort of triptych, three biographies. But your main, the main figure is Alice Kober. Tell us about who she was.
Alice Kober was an overworked, underpaid professor of classics right here at Brooklyn College. She was born in 1906, and on graduating from Hunter College in the 1920s as a classics major, announced to anyone who would listen that she would one day solve the riddle of Linear B. And of course, no one believed her. She was young, but she came very close before her own very premature death in 1950, 2 years before the riddle was solved. But until that point, throughout the 1930s and 40s, working on her own time for no recompense and little recognition, she was the one who sifted and pored over these bewildering inscriptions night after night at her dining table in Flatbush, looking for patterns. And she codified these patterns in the most extraordinary way. During World War II and for many years afterwards, paper was extremely scarce in this country. And so when she could no longer get the notebooks in which she made her hundreds and thousands of tabulations on the frequency of different characters in Linear B, undaunted, she cut out by hand ersatz index cards from the backs of any spare paper she could find, examination blue books, old greeting cards, church circulars, and an awful lot of checkout slips she pinched from the Brooklyn College library. And over the years, she hand-cut and annotated 180,000 of these index cards, and they are all now with the archive of her papers at the University of Texas. And she stored them in the one paper product that sadly she seemed to have no shortage of, and that was old cigarette cartons.
Where did that obsession, where did that interest come from?
Undeciphered scripts exert a hold on people and create in people a feeling that is indistinguishable from obsession. There is something so bewitching about seeing writing from the ancient past set down by flesh and blood people. It's a puzzle that you can't read. It's a secret you want to be let in on. And as I talk about in the book, the pull of an undeciphered script comes not only from the fact that you can't read it, but also from this really haunting knowledge that once, thousands of years ago, someone could read it, and you want to read it again.
In our review, Donovan Hone, who wrote Moby Duck, calls you a worthy Conan Doyle for this really mystery. It reads like a detective story. What was to you the most interesting moment of discovery in the story?
Well, archaeological decipherment is indeed a code-breaking story, and as such, it's all about process. It's all about, in this case, written in an unknown script. You have the linguistic equivalent, frankly, of a locked room mystery, and there is seemingly no way in. So the thrill for me in reading about the work of these decipherers, and I hope the thrill for readers of the book, will be in seeing how, in spite of all these obstacles, they manage to find tiny, almost completely obscured clues hidden within the script itself, clues in the forms of telling patterns, of configurations, of repeated characters. It's just the way, it's a much higher level version of the way you would go about attacking a cryptogram in your Sunday newspaper.
All right, well, more codes to be cracked. That was Marguerite Fox talking about The Riddle of the Labyrinth. Thanks, Margo.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the combined fiction list, there are really a bunch of new titles. Starting at the very top, this ties in well to your segment with Daniel Bergner and What Women Want, because it's a romance novel. Not just that, but a steamy, erotic romance novel called Entwined With You by Sylvia Day. This book is the third in a series she's been writing, the Crossfire series. She self-published the first book in the series, Bared to You, last year.
The 50 Shades of Grey model now?
Yeah, and it got snatched up by Berkeley. She originally planned it as a trilogy and now has announced that she'll write books 4 and 5 in the series. And I have to tell you, her fans are not pleased with that. If you buzz over to the Amazon site, it's gotten a lot of one-star reviews, not necessarily because of the quality or lack of quality of the writing, but because people feel taken that, you know, they wanted this to be a trilogy, they thought it was going to conclude, and now they're feeling just kind of strung along and with the cliffhanger endings.
They don't want more.
Exactly. Then at number 4, Stephen King has a new book out called Joyland. Walter Kern reviews it for us in the June 23rd issue. This book is kind of a Scooby-Doo type book. It's about a guy working at an amusement park, Joyland, that's a haunted amusement park. A woman has been killed there previously, and this guy has had his heart broken, and he's kind of in love with the ghost of this murdered woman.
And this is a book for hard case crime, which
What's interesting about this book is, so Stephen King, who was an early adapter to ebooks, and he wrote one book that he said was going to be ebook only. This time around, he decided that it will not be available as an ebook. It's published through Hard Case Crime. It's in paperback only. So it's interesting to see it so high on the combined list, because usually the combined list is heavy on ebooks. But here's a case where it's only selling in paperback. There are also audiobooks available, but you have to imagine that it's just the paperback here.
Well, it's kind of like an homage to the genre of those kind of...
Yeah, it's a real pulp fiction type story, and that's what Hard Case Crime does.
Although we should say that we know that pulp refers only to magazines, but...
Then also new on the list, each of these next books that are new on the combined fiction list are also on the hardcover list, but they're selling in hardcover and in ebooks. Lauren Weisberger is new at number 5 with Revenge Wears Prada. It is a sequel to her Devil Wears Prada from 10 years ago. Her protagonist, Andy Sachs, is now running a magazine of her own. At number 9, Jeffrey Deaver, a longtime thriller writer who writes about a quadriplegic investigator, a forensics expert. He's new on the list with a book called The Kill Room. at number 12, Ladies Night by Mary Kay Andrews, which is kind of a breezy summer read. It's a story of divorce and a woman seeking revenge on her ex-husband who she's kind of had all the good things of her life stripped away after she divorces her cheating husband, but she learns how to put her life back together on her own. I should note also one of the 15 most read fiction books across any platforms is Georgia Cates's self-published book, Beauty from Surrender. That's in its second week. It's at number 10 this week. It's the 10th most read work of fiction in any platform. But you go to Amazon and you look and it's on sale for 99 cents. And a lot of times there are pricing decisions.
Right. There are these flash sales, these one-day sales on certain
books. Yeah, and the self-published ones aren't even necessarily flash sales. They just sell at a very low price. And you know, if people are looking for a hot story or just a real plot-driven thing more than quality of writing, and they can get it for cheap, they'll buy it and they don't care really how good the book is. Then on the nonfiction side of things, you talk about the flash sales. The new number one title there is The Dog Lived and So Will I. The author's name is Teresa J. Ryan. That's a memoir first published in 2012. It was available earlier this month as a Kindle Daily deal, which is just the flash sale that you're talking about. For one day, it was on sale for $1.99, and here it is on the list suddenly.
I feel like dogs is such a huge genre that you have the subgenre of dog and illness books.
That's what this book is. It's a woman adopts a dog and finds out almost right away that the dog has cancer, and then immediately finds out that she also has cancer. And so it's about both of them overcoming their cancers together. At number five, the late Navy SEAL Chris Kyle, you may remember he was killed in February by a fellow veteran at a shooting range in Texas.
Right.
He, for a long time, was on the list with a memoir called American Sniper. He now is on the bestseller list at number five on the combined nonfiction list with a book called American Gun. William Doyle finished that book for him after Kyle was killed. It is a book looking at 10 different guns through the course of American history and how they helped win battles and how they have kind of shaped and coincided with American history. Then at number 14, Jen Lancaster has a book called The Tao of Martha. This book, The Tao of Martha, is a sort of gimmicky self-improvement project where she tries to live like Martha Stewart and doesn't. The subtitle of that book has something funny like, Why I'll Never Get the Glitter Off My Dog. Finally, on the combined nonfiction list, new at number 15, Jonathan Alter has a look at Barack Obama and his politics called The Center Holds that really takes him through re-election and the battles that he had to face navigating compromises. What's interesting about that is that over on the hardcover list, Colm McCann, who was the author of Let the Great World Spin, he has a new novel out called Transatlantic, and that's new on the hardcover fiction list at number 13. The book Transatlantic is about the historical ties really between America and Ireland, people crossing from one country to the next and then back again. One strand of that novel is about Frederick Douglass, who as an escaped slave in the 1840s made a trip to Dublin to raise money to promote his autobiography and raise support for the abolitionist
book
cause.
Tours also back in the day.
Exactly. And it was really to kind of build support for abolitionism right. in the U.S. Back in the 1840s. And McCann told me that as he was writing the Frederick Douglass section, he had very much in mind President Obama as a model. Partly he knew that Obama really admired Douglass and held him up as a hero. And partly it was the same question that Jonathan Alter talks about in The Center Holds, which is navigating the politics of the day, the compromises that you have to strike. You have this real idealist conscience, but the reality conscience necessarily. And McCann listed a bunch of instances where he saw Obama kind of walking that line, and he related it back to how Frederick Douglass had to walk that line when he was in Dublin. It was right at the start of the Irish potato famine, and he saw these people were doing horribly, and he felt he should maybe throw his support behind them as well. But he had his one cause that he was there to promote, and he never publicly voiced support for the victims of the famine.
A couple of welcome subjects of books with substance on this summary list.
Yeah, it's true. Colin McCann is a very literary title, new at number 13 on the hardcover list. And Philip Meyer, The Sun, is still on the list in its second week at number 12. So yeah, there's really some literary novels turning up in, among the summer
and
reading.
And he is also a guest on this week's podcast.
There you go.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.